Mic check, 1, 2, 1, 2. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Pony Development Sync for August 16th, 2017. Each time, it's like we're a little bit further into the future, and I get confused every single time. We don't have any RFCs to go over today for any voting or anything, but everybody should be aware, if you're listening to this and you missed on the mailing list, or you're somebody who doesn't really ever read emails, the RFC for improved Iter Tools API, that's pull request 101 on the RFC's repo, has gone into final comment and will be voted on next week. With that, shall we move along to PRs on the Pony C repo? Let's see. Oh, we got one of Benoit's, which is failing, one which is going through still in that. Okay, so here we go. Let's start with 2155. This is replace calls to malloc by calls to the pool allocator, 2155. Joe says this looks good, but we didn't get it before the sync. So let's have a quick look. What's the new available CPU size versus available CPU count, Benoit?
It's because the NUMA setup can modify the number of CPU available to the program. We need to remember the old CPU count because we will free the memory based on that size.
Ah. So, Joe, you already approved this. Sylvan, look good to you? You're muted, by the way, Sylvan, in case you're speaking.
Damn it. Yes, sorry. It looks good.
And rebase and merge. I don't think you should be allowed to mute yourself. I'm not sure that you're responsible enough for that, Sylvan.
I think you're clearly right.
Okay, 2151. Let's see. Also got the Joe thumbs up 6 days ago. 2151. Add the Pony Int message queue push single runtime function. More efficient push operation in the case of single producer, unsafe in multiple producer.
Oh, so this is leveraging the same optimization as the single in the NPM CQ.
Yes, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
Cool.
Nice. Boom. Yeah.
Split it up. Oh, that's very interesting. And so the only place we can ever use this is in constructors, but it is a nice win for constructors, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, maybe C code, if someone was brewing some C code and they were really sure about being a single producer, maybe they could.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Not passing. All right, those are the only ones that we have right now that are passing.
I have a quick question.
Mm-hmm.
Send message single in the scheduler. Is that because only the coordinating thread ever broadcasts like that?
Yeah, it's because schedulers only the first scheduler can receive messages from multiple scheduler platforms.
Right.
But other schedulers will only receive messages from the first scheduler.
Nice. Okay, that's particularly good. That's even better than the constructor optimization. Cool.
All right, so on to issues. Let's see, we have several here. So we have 2169, which has been open. There's been some discussion about it. It was open that the fold much slower than for loop.
Well, yeah. Why is this an issue?
Russell opened it because he was expecting it to be similar based on his experience with Rust, where they end up being the same in terms of performance. That's why the issue was opened.
Yeah, so Benoit had a comment about how we might be able to improve this regarding concrete Lambda types. I'm not sure how it plays out in practice, but I think it might have something to do with generic type inference.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, you would have to be iterating a particular... you'd have to be instantiating a version of Fold that does not do dynamic dispatch. And if you do that, then you have a chance to, you can not only get rid of the dynamic dispatch, but you have a chance to fully inline the code. Technically speaking, if it fully inlines the code and it would otherwise do dynamic dispatch, it might be able to get the optimization to get rid of the dynamic dispatch, but that's not always going to happen.
Can you elaborate on that last part?
Sure. So if LLVM inlines the fold call, the whole thing, then what it can do is it can go through and actually inline the lambda in place, and then it can notice that calling the lambda is yielding the same result no matter what, which is the apply function out of the lambda. So it can align the dynamic dispatch because it's inlined all the way through there and get static dispatch. And in fact, at that point, once it's got the static dispatch, it can inline the lambda call itself, right? That's the full fold optimization.
Yeah, I wonder what's standing in our way from that.
Just having a look real quick here at how this was written. Nothing in particular. So it's 70% slower. Actually, it's pretty good. Given that it's doing dynamic dispatch, 70% slower is kind of cool. This is an excellent example, too, by the way, that Russell did, because he made sure that it isn't optimizing stuff away that it would otherwise optimize away. So, awesome example. I think Benoit's right that probably is the biggest factor, which is with generic, if fold itself took a type parameter, which was the concrete lambda type, and then we inferred that, because obviously we want to infer that so to reduce programmer load, then we would definitely be able to get rid of dynamic dispatch, and that might be enough on its own.
Yeah, so maybe we can...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say maybe we could talk a little bit about what that might entail, the concrete lambda idea. Ideally, you know, we've talked about it as including, like a type parameter and generic type inference so that so that the caller doesn't have to give the type parameter. but I'm wondering if we can do better than that. I don't think we have the supporting code in the compiler right now to do this, but it would be nice if both the caller and the method signature itself didn't have to deal with that type parameter. If we just knew that, like, we always looked for optimization cases where you know the type of the lambda, you know the concrete type of the lambda at the call site, and tried to, like, sort of expand those out as if they, like, reify them as if they were type parameters, like add them to the reachability map, but without having any syntax requirements for doing that.
Right. Yeah.
And also one thing I would mention about, you know, having, if we have generic type inference that we're relying on for this, it might cause problems with, like, if somebody's trying to, because now, you know, with my PR that's hopefully going to get finished and merged soon for lambda inference, you know, the lambda is often going to be looking to the left-hand side to complete, you know, like the parameter types or the object cap or whatever. And the generic type inference is always going to be looking to the right-hand side, so we're going to have to be careful that we're not introducing a spot where we lose the benefits of the lambda inference due to also inference.
Sure, yeah. Right. I think that's – you're absolutely right. That's a common problem, right, is you hit some undecidable point and you realize, oh, bugger, I've got to back out here. And definitely. I think for the performance stuff, the generic type inference is more just about reducing programmer load, and always you'd be able to specify a type if you wanted to, much as with the lambda stuff, right? So I think that's okay in that sense. I mean, it's, I guess it would, the question there then is, as Benoit says, do we need the equivalent of a decal type to say, since we don't have a concrete type for that specific lambda that's immediately accessible, it being an anonymous type, would we have to then write decal type in some situations? And I sure hope not.
So I mean, what I was getting at is that I think there should be a way to make this optimization without any extra syntax requirements on the user. If the lambda is a lambda, let's assume the lambda is always a lambda literal that is resolved, like, in the expression pass, in that call, in the call site, then you've got, by the time you get out to running the expression pass for the method call, you've got the anonymous type of the lambda right there.
Yep, absolutely.
So it comes into, like, figuring out how can we change how we're doing the code generation and think about can we reify that concrete type in as, like, an optimization that the user doesn't see.
So you don't write it as a generic method, but we go ahead and
treat it like one.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I'm not really sure. I see the benefit of doing that because it doesn't really the way I see it, it doesn't really reduce the load on the programmer, but it would add a lot of additional logic in the compiler. Because it's effectively making a non-generic method generic, but without the syntax.
Okay.
Right. I mean, that is what I'm proposing. But I mean, I think that in terms of, you know, does it make it simpler on the user? I think it definitely does, because you're saying that, you know, I'm accepting, you know, this lambda type for my parameter and not having to deal with assigning it to a type parameter for the method.
Well, I mean, maybe I'm misunderstanding what you're saying, but for lambda type as type parameters, what we can do is have the type constrained to the have the type parameter constrained to the abstract lambda type, and then once generic type inference is in, to infer the parameter to the concrete lambda type. And maybe I'm missing something, but I don't think we'd ever need to specify the type ourselves. Well, you'd have to change the method signature to add the type parameter, but I think that's all.
Yeah, I mean,
I think the only thing that we would end up ever having to do is if we were leaving off a bunch of information on the lambda because of lambda inference, we might need to specify not the type of the lambda in that signature, but one of the missing types that couldn't be inferred somewhere, if that makes any sense. Like, I'm looking at specifically at the example that Russell has in using fold. And if we were to infer the type in the lambda of T and I and the return type.
Right. It conflicts with the type inference that I'm working on right now.
Couldn't you infer it from the constraint of the type parameter?
Theoretically, yes, but only if... So when you're at the lambda, you're like, due to the way the compiler is structured, it's really not easy, because when you're processing the expression pass for the lambda, you don't necessarily have access to know like if the user is providing an explicit type argument to the call or not. What I'm trying to target is a scenario where we're relying on, where you don't have to specify the type argument, and you also get to take advantage of the lambda inference that I'm adding right now. So in this case, when you're processing the lambda, if a type argument was not provided, you're right. You could just go to the constraint and constrain by that. And then the type argument gets inferred as just being, I guess it would get inferred as just being the constraint itself with no further refinement. But you don't know when you're processing the lambda in the expression pass, you don't know whether that type argument is going to be provided or not. So the user could have provided some more specific type there, and you wouldn't know it until you bubble up to the to processing the call itself. And at that point, the lambda is supposed to already be completely decided.
Yeah, I mean, this is why in ML style languages, you often end up with this unification stuff that happens, and it ends up being almost like it's a whole own little prologue to do this kind of type inference for exactly the reason that you're describing, Joe.
Yeah. I mean, and again, the other point is that I don't really like the idea of making everyone rewrite and like basically making it best practice to never use a lambda directly directly as the type of a parameter, and it always has to be like a type parameter instead. That seems like extra work that we're kind of imposing on people for what is really just kind of a runtime optimization.
Hmm. Yeah, I see what you mean. So I think once we have generic type inference in, and by the way, I'm currently working on an implementation. I think I'll investigate what we can do in this area and how we can resolve potential conflicts.
Cool. You know, interestingly, I'm thinking about what Joe said about making it simpler, not just on the user of the API, but on the API writer. I think that's sort of what you were getting at. Is that right, Joe?
Yeah, that's what I'm getting at, is that, you know, basically, if we did it the way we're describing with, you know, rely on generic type inference, we'd be saying to everyone, okay, best practice is don't use a lambda type as a parameter, always use as a type parameter, and then use that constraint as the, you know, like we're introducing a best practice that adds more verbosity to the writer of the API.
Whereas what we could do is infer type parameters, where we could say, oh, look, here's something that's a non-concrete type.
Oh. And
what we could do is, for anything that's a non-concrete type, we could say it's actually bound by that type. But it could be more you could always say that it was more specific.
Right. Right, which is already like allowed by the type system. You were not changing the semantics of the language, we're just making an optimization internally.
Exactly.
And so then, go ahead.
And then what we'd really want to do then is be very careful of code bloat. We don't want to be generating all these, it could just get bad code bloat wise. Because as much as it is an optimization in this kind of small example, it's totally an optimization. And in the case of Fold, it's probably always an optimization to do this stuff. But in this more general case that I'm describing right now, we would want to be careful where actually dynamic dispatch and code sharing would be faster than the constant microcode decoding and L1I blowout and TLB misses that you end up with if you have too much code bloat. But I do think it's interesting that I think what you're referring to, Joe, could be done by inferring that the function should be generic when it wasn't specified as such.
Yeah. I mean, that's definitely one possibility. Yeah, the code bloat thing is one thing to worry about, as you mentioned. And also, you know, I think we're getting into territory where it's making the compiler much more complex to have the, you know, not only the type argument inference, but also the type parameter inference. Like, it's potentially getting you know, harder to maintain there. And I'm still kind of worried about the conflict of the resolution that we were talking about, but Benoit's going to look at it. So yeah,
I think you're right to be a little worried about that. So far we've done, I think, a pretty nice job of finding a good sweet spot for Pony in terms of doing local type inference and not getting into anything that requires complex unification. This might require a little bit more complex unification. On the other hand, oh boy, as a programmer, on the programmer side of it, I adore the idea of having the combination of lambda type inference and generic type inference. It seems like a beautiful combination. So if we can work it out, that would be beautiful.
Yeah, so I saw that Benoit already kind of started reviewing my PR for lambda inference, so that's good because it means that he's kind of aware of the approach that I'm taking.
Awesome.
I'm hoping to be ironing that out when I get some time here. If nothing else, hopefully I'll finish it this weekend and get it ready for final review. So that's exciting.
Excellent. That's super exciting.
That was a pretty big digression. I don't know if we want to get back into PRs and issue tickets.
That was so exciting. I feel like I don't know quite what to cover next. I'm going to write a note to Russell on this because I think it's a really good issue and an excellent example.
All right. So while you're doing that, Sylvan, we have a thing that was tagged a few weeks ago that I have not been doing a good job of bringing up, but issue 1708, you self-assigned yourself on that back in March. Nested lambdas can't auto-capture free references from outer scope. and there's a question of what's up with that?
What's up with that, unfortunately, is I have not actually looked at that.
So we should probably just unassign you from it?
Good idea.
Okay. There we go. So that's a free one. Again, if anybody wants to pick up a somewhat difficult but not incredibly difficult one, that's issue 1708.
I might take a look once I finish with Lambda Inference, since I'm already mucking around in there.
Okay. Since you are already King Lambda.
King Lambda.
I like that. yeah. I like that title. King Lambda, Sovereign of Green Space.
All of the Lambdas shall have green space.
So, this is one we'd never actually discussed with Benoit and Sylvan in the same place at once, right? So, and we marked it as something we needed to revisit next week, and that was April 12th when we did that. So, how about we look at 1513 for a minute?
Oh boy. Gotta find it first. Ah, here we go.
Just so we can at least remove the "it needs discussion," where Benoit thought it was related to tuples, not having a type descriptor, and Sylvan, you didn't, and that's where we got to.
Oh dear. Okay.
And what, if anything, even for like an exploration or anything, we might be able to do, I guess.
I don't remember that one at all.
I'm so glad you're in the same boat, Benoit. It makes me feel better.
Good. Have a look again. And while you're doing that, I'm going to verify that this still crashes. All right?
Thank you.
Okay, so, well, there's good news and bad news.
Okay.
It's a different error. There's still an LLVM error, but it's a different one at this point in time.
Is it from GenesignCast?
Yes, it is. On okay. 9. Yep. LLVM get kind type. I'm going to update it with this info, all right?
Cool.
Latest. Cool.
As long as it's from Genesign type, then it's likely to be the same actual error.
Yeah. I just dropped it in.
All right. Thank you. Oh. That's quite interesting. So we're catching it now. Something that we've just have noticed should definitely not happen.
And
it's happening.
and the fix is still, if you comment out that one line.
Okay.
It will compile. My goodness, I have so many.
All right, I'm clearly confusing myself.
I'm building a debug file where I'm going to get some LLDB info. All right.
Cool. So it's line 306 that's falling over. It's unboxing it and not getting a struct, which to say that that's unexpected is an understatement.
Okay. Here comes the backtrace. I haven't actually looked at the backtrace myself yet. I'm just dropping it in.
Ah. Okay, so it might be calling genunbox, and genunbox is just saying, I don't know what you're talking about. The CT primitive is null, is my guess. And it says, this is not a primitive type. What are you telling me this for?
Very long pause for people who are on the it's dramatic.
Dramatic in a very unsatisfying way. Looking at the backtrace, yeah, that's exactly the same amount of information.
Yeah. Sometimes the backtrace is helpful. Sometimes,
yeah, absolutely. And this time it just didn't happen to give anything more than the lovely pony assert. I'm also building a debug compiler at the moment. All right.
Dun, 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 dun.
Oh. Isn't it a problem with the cast from union of tuples to tuple of union? Because if you look at the add function in the post message, the type of the if is a union of tuples. And the CMRDT counter op is a tuple containing a union.
Wait. I'm confused. What?
So if you look at the add function, there is a if in that. In the then it returns a tuple with add and number, and
yes.
The else it returns deck and number.
Uh-huh.
So The global type of the if is the union of the then type and the else type. So it's a union of a tuple of add U128 and the tuple of deck and U128. But the RDT counter hook type is actually a tuple of well, with the first member is a union of add and deck, and the second member is a U128. So that means when we exit the if to assign to assign the result of the if to the OP local, we have to convert the onion of tuples that we got from the if to a tuple of onion. And I think it's related to that, because I don't see what else could be crashing in that code. Also, it looks like it's corresponding to the assert location in the code, because we are in a assigned local. So I'm not sure what the actual underlying issue is, but I think it's in that area of the code. I don't know if I was very clear.
Yeah, you were, and I'm just now. I just dumped the AST out of frame. Well, I broke in that gen unbox and gen assign cast, and then if we go four frames up from there, there's a gen assign that we're passing the AST into there.
Mm-hmm.
And it is indeed an assign of where the left-hand side is op, and it has a type of a tuple of a union and a nominal, and the whole thing has a value of a tuple of a union and a nominal. And the right-hand side is the result of the if expression exactly as Benoit said. And that thing is a union of two tuples. The type is a union of the tuple type add U128 and the second tuple type deck U128. It is precisely what Benoit said it would be.
Wow. Nicely done. Nicely done.
Yes, so I think we have that's a long-standing issue, isn't it?
Yeah.
So Benoit was right in the first place. It's a tuple descriptor thing.
Well. It's a little bit complex. Possibly tuple descriptors would handle this. It's a bit complex because it's the if expression. And the if expression really wants to say that this is a union of two tuple types, because you have branch one and branch two. And one of the things to do is to say, look, we're going to give up entirely on this idea of tuples of unions and unions of tuples because it's endless trouble, and it is in every darn language. It's not just Pony. And say what we need is some a little bit of type inference flowing the other direction to tell us which one to choose. And in this case, CMCRDT counter-op would tell us what to choose. That's unfortunate. That means that we have a little bit more complex type inference happening there. Also, it's unfortunate in that we should be able to figure that out even without that let op having a type, because we should figure out from the fact that op is then constrained to be CMRDT counter op. And the funny thing is, there isn't a preference here. If we said, oh, we should prefer tuples of unions to unions of tuples, then all we would have to do is write this the other way around to say that CMRDT counter op is add comma U128 or dec comma U128 to hit the same issue.
So to be clear, are you suggesting we should do this as a code gen operator or as a type sugar operator?
I'm not suggesting either, to be honest. I don't think I've got a good solution. Yeah, whereas if we handled this entirely at code gen, and that might just be the better way to do it. No, you're right, Benoit. This should be done at, this shouldn't be a type checking issue, should it? It should be done at code gen. You're right. And then we leave the type checking as it is, and it's a question of when we run into this stuff, we're willing to do more complex tuple code gen to overcome it. And maybe in that case, it's exactly the tuple descriptors that get us out of this problem, because we carry the information around exactly as you said in the first place. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it's been a while since I looked at that part of the code gen, so I'm not that familiar anymore with that.
Do we think we could get a summary of the general ideas here? Well, okay, that's not a summary. That's just a, oh no, Benoit's right.
Sorry, that wasn't in response. I was already doing that.
Yeah. I figured as much. It popped up while I was speaking, so.
Yeah. So if in GenAssign cast, not to get too specific about this, but here we are. So we're actually ending up with the compile type is not a primitive type for the right-hand side, which is, of course it's not, because it's a union of tuples, not a tuple of unions. So when we get to line 302 in genexpr.c, where the left-hand side is a struct and we know we're going, oh, we're going to assign this to a tuple, cool. And then we get to line 303 and we say, is it a pointer? It says, yep, absolutely. And we get to line 305 and we're saying, well, it must be a boxed tuple then. And it says, no, this is not a boxed tuple. This is a union type of two different tuples. So it is a boxed tuple, but it's mildly different from what you thought it was. And I think actually, if the fix goes in basically in that area of around 305, that might be sufficient. I'll make some notes.
That sounds good. Notes. Notes would be good. Notes, good. Okay. So we only have a few minutes left. While Sylvan's making some notes, did anybody have anything that they wanted to bring up? Okay, well, I guess then we're going to be at the, I guess we're at the end here, unless we want to, do we want to try tackling a another issue, or?
I have a weird thing I could bring up.
Okay.
This actually, so this has some practical impact, but is anyone aware of cases where it can point a comparison of a tag pointer to a non-tag pointer is a hot path where a few extra instructions would be a problem?
Can you go through that one more time?
So imagine you have some object instance O, and you have X, which is a T tag that points to O, and you have Y, which is a T ref that points to O. Are there cases where that kind of thing is, if X is Y, then that sort of comparison is on a hot path where a few extra instructions, like 7 to 10 extra instructions, would be problematic?
Wait, so I have
two pointers. They're the same
pointer. Two pointers to the same thing. One's a tag and the other's a ref.
Yeah.
We might have that.
Yeah, I can see that theoretically. I'm just like hypothesizing here. I can see that theoretically be used in cases where you've got like a, you're creating an object like to use as a reference to pass out like for somebody who is sending a response back to you, and then you use that to like correlate it to the response in like a map is.
So, yeah. So, in a map is, actually, it wouldn't be an issue. Because in the map is, you wouldn't be doing the comparison. You'd actually be comparing the tag to the tag in order to look up the thing itself. So, it would be, you wouldn't, there is no actual is between the tag pointer and the ref pointer.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I was thinking, I guess it wouldn't necessarily be a map is, but some sort of like similar construct that was set up. I'm trying to think of like you have like a set of states that's associated with something that went out to another actor, and the actor send it back to you with the reference to the state. And so then you need to like look up that internally and recall it.
So the reason I'm thinking it might not be is because all of these cases keep coming back to these more complex data structures where you actually end up comparing the tag to the tag in order to find the ref, or, you know, insert other capabilities here. That's okay. Much like how the hierarchical timing wheel works.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Because like the case I was talking about, you probably have a map is where the key is a is tag and the value's the same object as ref.
Yeah.
And that wouldn't be slowed down by what I'm thinking about.
Right.
It'd be fine. Because comparing a tag to a tag would still be a direct 64/32, I suppose, bit comparison operator. Comparison instruction, I should say.
So here's a question. I thought that the tag representation of something at runtime is the same as the ref representation of it.
It absolutely is. So this totally is not an issue at the time. I told you this was going to be a weird question. but I've been thinking about some garbage collection stuff where it would be very convenient to be able to garbage collect entirely objects for which only tag references remain. And it actually has to do with a possible way to write a GC for garbage collecting things that were passed in messages that could be theoretically faster.
So, but you can't garbage collect an object for which only tag references remain.
So, actually, it turns out maybe...
an actor, right?
An actor, right? No, not an actor. That's different.
Okay. Yeah, I meant to say actor, but I realized I said object.
Okay. Because actually, like about 16 hours ago, I thought we totally couldn't collect an object for which only tag references remain. So I thought that was a perfectly reasonable thing to say.
Yeah, I guess the place where it might cause problems is like if somebody's using an FFI trick where they're keeping a tag reference around in order to keep something.
In which case... they like, would expect the contents to possibly be collected anyway, right?
Well, it would be like a case where like something in C retains a reference to read from it. Like I'd be modeling the case like where if I'm treating like the C code I'm dealing with as an actor,
right?
And I would send it. I'm sending it the ref conceptually, and I'm holding on to the tag. Just
right now, the GC would the only way it would thing it would protect was be the object itself and not its contents, because anything it pointed to it would just go ahead and collect because it wouldn't trace through the tag.
Okay. So you're already not like it, so if I'm holding a string, if I'm holding a string tag and I pass the contents of the pointer, if I pass the C pointer to something over in C, I'm not protecting that pointer from getting garbage That's collected. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So that trick doesn't work already. All right. Yeah. Well, we're not breaking anything new.
Yeah. You'd have to actually keep this a string box or stronger to protect the contents.
Or keep the C pointer tag, right?
Absolutely.
In which case, this would break. If you were using that trick, this would break it.
Ah, I see. If you were keeping the pointer you ate.
Right.
Yep, this would break it. If you kept it as a tag. If you kept it as anything else, it wouldn't break.
Right, but you might not be able to get it as anything but a tag, right? Because...
quite likely you could only get it as a tag, actually.
Yeah. So you'd have to hold on to the containing object.
Yeah. Or, you know, use that pinning mechanism. Say, hey, reference count this thing.
Or maybe pointer gets special case. I don't know whether that is reasonable or not.
Yeah.
I mean, you run into the same problem if you were... I think you used this trick before where you use a class, use an empty class as a trick for an opaque... an opaque pointer that was allocated by the other program, but I guess if it's allocated by the C, then it's going to get freed by the C and not by you anyway.
Right. And if we were doing it for markers in Pony and we only kept tags, the tags would themselves would still be meaningful and would never be equal to other tags. we could just garbage collect the underlying object while maintaining the tag as a unique identifier.
Uh-huh.
So if we were doing it purely as a marker, like in a mint type situation, then that marker would still be valid.
Right.
But we would GC the memory associated with the marker. Interestingly, it's actually kind of a win there.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. So I guess going back to the other case, I guess I'm just trying to think of cases where you'd want to do that. I mean, one, like another case might be like a broadcast. Like let's say that you've got an actor that sends out a message to a list of actors, and for each one, it includes the. This is a little bit contrived. It includes the tag for that actor as one of the arguments, and then each actor says, okay, is this one me? If so, I'll do something. If not, I'll do the other thing.
Right.
So maybe one case would be like you want to ignore it if it's you, right? Like, so if you're, so let's say an actor is sending to a broadcast bus actor that then sends out to all of the actors in its list, and then the actor says, okay, is this one me? If so, ignore.
Right. Yeah. There you would pay for it. But I think the cost of that compared to you shouldn't have sent that message in the first place is theoretically quite small.
Yeah, I mean, because the bus, if you're trying to optimize that, the bus should be ignoring it for you because the bus has the tag already.
Right. Yeah.
And it'd already be looping over the list. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Sean, you said you might have a case. Does it?
I'd have to go look, but I think all of ours are probably map ises.
Okay.
Right. So, I mean, like we do stuff where it's like, hey, we have tag references to these things that exist somewhere else in maps, and yeah, where it might be ourselves. But I'd have to take a look. See.
Okay. So it sounds like the answer here is it's not definitely wrong to look at this approach. And hey, that's better than it being definitely wrong.
Yeah. Maybe you can open up an issue ticket about it and Sean can kind of put that on.
Yeah, I don't think it's quite ready for that yet. I'll just keep it's basically this means this isn't a full immediate stop. It's something that I can pursue a line of thinking about. So that's good. Okay.
Yeah, just checking to say if somebody says, no, don't do that.
Well, eventually it might impact on somebody, but on the other hand, yeah.
The end goal here would be, it's possible we could end up without ever having to send Orca messages of any kind.
That could be worth it. Pardon everyone who's listening. I know the train of thought that this came from then, based on that statement.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
You timed that perfectly because it's like the end of the call and now everyone.
Also, look, like this really might not work. I don't want to get too into this. This might be a stupid thing that turns out not to work at all. So,
yeah, that thing we talked about a few months ago. Right. Yeah.
And then special credit today to a conversation I had with Matt Parkinson, who, if no one's looked at his work, they totally should. So I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, it's cool that actually, that might be possible. Okay. Anyway, yes. Otherwise we're here for a really long time and not right now. So we're going to end this one. Right. And I'll say thank you everyone for coming and I'm hitting stop.